If you had like a little cut in the bamboo stick and you tried to pry it apart, it'd be very, very difficult. But if you had a cut that was going all the way down, it's very easy to split that bamboo stick in half.
Asian analogy.
Anyway, I have used that to explain to my patient.
Hi everyone. So welcome to another episode of The Bite Angle. All right. Over here we have Dr. Dustin.
Hey.
And Dr. Peng Ru.
Hello.
All right. So we're all from Dental Designs. And today we're going to talk more about dental crowns. And we get a lot of questions about dental crowns. And, you know, so like how dental crowns, what are dental crowns in the first place? And why is it benefiting us? And what are the precautions you should take when choosing the correct dentist to do a dental crown? I guess let's start. So what's a dental crown, Dr. Peng Ru? Do I become a king or queen from this? Huh?
No. What? Basically, it's just like something that covers the tooth a bit more than what a normal filling would.
Yeah.
Yeah. You need to do that when the tooth is like a bit more broken down or it's a bit weak because you had root canal treatment done. And it can be made of many materials. Ceramics, there's like zirconia, Emax, there's like PFM and like metal crowns. Yeah.
And like, what's the colloquial term in, cause you work in public, in the public sector in Singapore, right? What was the colloquial term for like a crown? Was it a crown?
Cap.
Is it a cap?
Cap.
But yeah. Isn't a cap like a filling as well, they say?
Yeah.
Like,
I don't know.
Okay.
I don't know.
I think that's one of the more confusing things that I've encountered in Singapore. Because all the time, like, we put in the schedule, oh, you're doing a cap on tooth number 2-4. And I was thinking to myself, a cap? This will see a filling. But yes, I guess.
Yeah. So like, when I first started, I mean, I started in Australia, right? Cap is always like a filling, but it's so it's a cap. Okay.
Yeah. I guess most people think of it as a cap because like, that's why you put in a head, right? Like, it just like covers your head. So. But I guess it could be a crown too.
Okay, I understand. So you know what was the process like in the public system? Was it
still quite smooth?
Yes.
Yeah, but two visits usually more than a week apart. So the usual anesthesia, most likely. Prepare the tooth. Probably take about an hour and a half. And then you take a conventional impression with...
Like a mole, basically.
Like a mole. Okay. And then you send the patient off, send the impression, the mole to the lab. Then they will get it done in usually more than a week. Before the patient goes, of course, you have to put a temporary crown on the tooth. That's usually how it is.
Okay.
I'm being a bit generous by saying more than a week apart. I think it's closer to like 3 weeks, if I'm not wrong.
I think it really depends on where, you send to and the scheduling and things like that, right? Yeah. So can really change and sometimes the temporary comes off. Right. So, is it the same in America? Like,
yeah, it's the same. Usually it was like a standard 2-week turnaround for that. But then I think as labs started to go a little bit more modelless, it ended up a lot of the turnaround times were a lot faster. So
okay.
People could turn it around in like a week or so. Same thing across the pond.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay, cool. I guess now with modern technology is a lot faster now. I mean, we have the scanner, we have the milling machine. So we can actually turn that out, same day as well, I guess. Do you get a lot of patients still asking you guys, is my crown better, less durable compared to a lab crown? Do you get that sometimes?
You get that from patients. I mean,
I get that sometimes. Like, they say, you are doing a same day crown. It's not as good as someone that does like a 2-week crown.
I think there is like a little bit of a distinguishing factor, right? There are some people who can do chairside crowns and turn it around within half an hour or 45 minutes, however long it takes them to be able to mill and to bake. But I think one of the great things about our office is that we actually have that in-house lab, right? So we actually have lab techs who are reviewing the cases, making sure that it's up to the very highest quality standards that you can possibly have. So in that sense, I think
we can kind And of the materials are the same, actually. Yeah, yes. Like just to, like, because they think that the material is inferior. No, it's the same. It's the same. Actually, I think, like, you take full control of it as well because you know the material from exactly where it is. Yep. Whereas if you send it to a lab, they might have something from somewhere else and it's not like, you know, authentic, things like that. And so that's why I get always, I have to like always explain like it's the same or even better and as well. And I think that what you raised up was a good point. Like it's also like it's really depending on the skill of the dentist because the chair side has a sort of a bad rap. I don't know whether you had that in America as well. But it's just like, just a quick turnover, very fast, just, you know, do something, do a prep and then just straight away you can get the crown done. But it gets a bad rap because the dentist just rushing it, right?
Yeah. I think, if you look at it, I think one of the main differences, because I've worked in chairside practices and, you know, the crowns are fine, the marginal fit is fine and everything. But I will say that, I think the anatomy of having, like, how a crown looks and how it's shaped, having that being looked at by a dental technician just really makes all the difference in terms of, how it visually looks. And functionally, too, I'm sure it makes a difference as well. But oftentimes, like, these crowns that are done chairside, you kind of look at it and you're like, oh.
They look like a pebble.
Yeah, yeah. It's like, it doesn't have the definition. It doesn't look like a natural tooth as much. And so I think you're really, you know, getting the best of both worlds by having the lab tech here, being able to do a digital workflow, but also a fast turnaround time with a really high quality product.
You know what the technicians do when you're free? Have you gone into the room and they've? I got them to study. So like they have an anatomy book and they'll carve out in wax and then like they get rated and then they will send their work online like on our Slack channel to actually. Mm. We will critique the word, things like that. So that's how they learn. And I think they actually are better like in anatomy than a lot of dentists, right? I just think that sometimes we just create something that we don't know, but they see it every day. They see that thing every day, right? So yeah.
Absolutely.
And is there preference for materials? Just now you were talking about a lot about zirconia, EMX, PFM, which is porcelain fused metal, right?
Yeah.
It's in the public system. What is mostly commonly used? I just wondering.
I guess it depends on the position of the tooth in the arch.
Mm-hmm.
But I think for sevens, they usually just go full metal.
Like second molars, okay.
Second molars. And it's either zirconia or porcelain fused to metal.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. And is there a protocol that they follow, or is it just dependent on the dentist?
It's dependent on the dentist.
Okay.
And also for different materials, you send to different labs, and you just kind of know what kind of quality of the work comes up from that lab, and if you don't want to send it to that lab, then you just
So it's really
sometimes
it's like
that.
For all, I guess.
Yes.
Is it the same in America as well? Were you in public system in America?
I went to a school that was in a public system, but I didn't work for the government or a county or anything like that.
Okay. Was it very, very different from a private practice? I don't know.
I mean, like,
I'm so curious. Is it gonna be okay? I hope that.
I don't think it's. I don't think practicing in the U.S. was wholly different. I mean, it sounds like my education system was actually probably pretty similar. I think. If anything, probably you were exposed to a wider range of materials just because, I mean, we didn't really bond crowns. I mean, that wasn't like as much of a thing when I was learning. Ours was very much traditional crown preps.
So that means we're trimming all the way down to the gums, right?
Yeah. So, a more aggressive style. I mean, there's still definitely a place for traditional crown preps for sure. But, you probably had a little bit more varied in that. I think it became more in vogue to do these kind of less traditional, more conservative crown preps when you were training. So that's something that we had to learn postgraduate.
I mean, that's not really true.
My assumption again.
But I can't elaborate. That's not true.
Yeah, okay. So speaking about more aggressive and non-aggressive, I guess I think a lot of the times my patients are thinking of a dental crown as like a commodity. Like I'm gonna get a dental crown done. It's and any dentist it doesn't really matter. You know, I'm just gonna get a crown done because I mean from the superficial part of it, it looks the same, right? Like a crown looks the same as that.
Yeah.
And the more tooth you trim, the more it looks nicer, right? Right? Because because then that's when the dental technician has more room to like change stuff and like put more colors on things like that. And so, you know, nowadays we are, you know, doing more conservative approach. And I know you're really big on it.
Yeah.
You're super, really, really big. You just did a before and beyond on it, right?
Yeah.
Can you like, will tell us what you usually do, like if you can try to save the tooth?
I think what I really have in mind is always to just prepare the tooth where there are defects. So where it's decaying, where there are cracks, where there are old fillings. That's as much as I want to trim the tooth down to just that level.
So you're removing the defects.
Yeah,
right.
Just remove the defects and see what we have. And if that's enough, then I don't want to go anymore.
Yep.
Yeah. Because everything else is technically healthy. And if the tooth is already going to need something like a crown, that means it's probably quite broken down. And I think the logic here is that we want to try to save as much healthy tooth structure as possible. Because I guess at the end of the day, everything has a lifespan. Whatever we put in the mouth is going to fail, and we want to try to get predictable failure so that if anything fails, it's the restoration that fails and the underlying tooth is still restorable and we can avoid an extraction. Yeah. I think that's my mindset right now.
Okay, yeah, I mean, that's the same philosophy.
Mm.
And Dustin, do you in sort of that aspect, do you always tell the patient, hey, look, you're going to trim as little as possible and protect it. And then, you know, subsequently, what do you...
Yeah, I think at the end of the day, like, I mean, I think no matter how we treat a tooth, whether it's a traditional or more conservative way, like, at the end of the day, we can always put, like, a crown onto a tooth and the patient's probably going to be happy. But I think that Pongru brings up a really, really important point that not all retreatability is the same, right? So, you know, I think we want to work on the tooth keeping in mind that at some point it may end up failing. And if it ends up failing, we really want it to be a favorable failure if it happens. And so I can't really stress that enough because I do think that's exceptionally important to consider. And Pongru and whenever we do these really conservative restorations, I would say it's actually more time consuming and more difficult to do these conservative restorations.
It's actually harder and we charge the same as a regular crown. Yeah.
So we spend all this extra time to be able to do this. The patient's probably not going to know the difference when they feel it inside their mouth. But I think at the end of the day, we've done them a much better service because we have conservative so much tooth structure and it's just overall better, I think.
So I think the biggest thing that for my part was that like I always tell my patient, do you want which one to break, your tooth or like the restoration, like the crown? Do you want to, and if you want the crown to break, then you got to do more, you can do more conservative, right? And I think a lot of dentists want to do a crown because number one, it's easier to do, I guess. And it's easier to glue it on. And also when it fails, the tooth breaks, right? Usually and not the crown. And so they can blame like, right? I think that's, they can say, hey, my crown didn't break. It's your tooth that is weak and it broke.
Yeah.
Right?
Yes. Damn. And
shaking my head.
I think to be clear, like, it wasn't always possible to do this, right? I mean, like...
Okay, fair enough.
I think a lot of us are, like, trained on traditional methods. And like I said, I think there's a time and definitely a place for traditional crowns.
Yeah.
But I think... before we didn't have the ability to be able to do something that's non-retentive that didn't hold in there. Like we weren't be able to.
I think the cements and the science behind all this bonding was not great.
Yeah.
And so maybe the dentist was like a bit older. He, you know, like a lot of the dentists that train in that era don't really believe in bonding, right?
Yeah.
So that's why. it happens, right? Yeah.
But I think to be rest assured, like there's a, definitely a paradigm shift, I think, in how most dentists nowadays are starting to look at it. Like it is definitely like it's not a just a trendy thing. Like it's something that's definitely here to stay. I think there have been, you know, long term follow ups, and these have been very, very successful. So
yeah, like onlays and ceramic onlay,
exactly,
things like that. I think it's a lot more. Although I would say that it actually is not for everyone. Bonding, like this very conservative sort of treatment for, like as a replacement for conventional crowns, right? Because like if you can't really bond well, and I teach as well, right? And some people are like very into bonding, and they say, hey, I'm going to be very conservative and everything. But if you don't take the proper steps to actually glue it on, then you're going to get failures very easily. Because it's so technique sensitive.
Yeah.
I know when I was just graduated and I started doing all these things, I had a number of failures, right? Because like it's like, oh, you need to make sure that you put a rubber dam on.
Yeah.
You're going to make sure that you have a sandblaster and things like that. It's a lot of work.
Yeah.
Rather than you just trim a lot of tooth away, right? Yeah.
And to be clear, too, I think, like, at least from my experience in the States, I would say this whole thing with rubber dams and this type of level of isolation is not the norm. I wouldn't say a majority of dental offices go to these
lengths. Yeah, it's not the norm.
Exactly.
Yeah. I would say, like, 80% is still doing the traditional way.
Exactly.
Yeah.
It's the same here.
Yeah. And to be honest, I don't think it's right or wrong. Well, I don't know. I think it's important for us to just give the freedom of choice to the patient, I guess, right? Yeah. Because I have patients where, I would usually tell them, hey, you got two options, whether you want to do conservative or like regular, like conventional. And if I'm going to do zirconia, I'm going to bond it. And if it's high strength, right? And so you got to trim down the tooth, right? And how do you usually approach the subject on this? Do you usually tell them about materials and for both options, or, you know, or do you say, hey, look, I think you're grinding a lot. Zirconia.
I mean, I think it's a pretty easy discussion for most patients in the sense that, I too, like Peng Ru, I think you're going to have a conversation with the patient and say, my goal is to conserve as much tooth structure as I possibly can.
And you can sort of smell that straight away, right? When they come in, they're like, it's like, yes, I want to save my
tooth. Like, I'm down for it. Like, yeah, I also want to save my tooth structure, right? Like, it's not a difficult conversation to have.
Mm.
Now, for those other situations where, like, for example, sevens, I think, the last teeth in your mouth, they tend to be under a lot of stress.
Yeah.
And so those are situations where I would probably be more inclined to do something that's more traditional.
Mm.
For that, I mean, I think when I say the word crown, people naturally gravitate towards their, like, what their idea is, a traditional crown. So I don't need to do them convincing otherwise. I'm just like, you need a traditional crown on a seven, right?
I just say it's a crown, then I just say it's a half crown or whatever. No, then the worst thing is they say, do you have any discount if it's half crown? Because it's actually harder, right? Like we said, right? It's actually harder to do
it's
half
much
crown.
More time than
yeah.
No, that's absolutely right.
Yeah, it's true. Like, I still do regular crowns. It's by no means.
Yes. Mm. And I think also there's like a paradigm shift where I think when I was originally doing crowns, it was very much of like bracing the tooth together, like putting something on top, like a helmet, holding everything together.
Mm.
But I think now I've come to the realization that, I don't know, maybe it's because I have like an engineering background that it becomes more like clear to me now. But, I think teeth now, what it is, how weak the tooth, especially when it comes to fractures. I think fractures.
For the viewers out there, crowns are, if we didn't mention it, crowns are meant for cracked teeth or really heavily broken down teeth that we need to reinforce with a crown or something like that to protect the tooth from further damage.
So I think the goal of a lot of these indirect or crown restorations that we're doing is really just to like shrink the size of the crack, because a tooth is much easier to crack and to break when that crack is long. And so if you're able to just reduce that size of that that crack. It's kind of like a bamboo section, stick. Right? If you had like a little cut in the bamboo stick and you tried to pry it apart, it'd be very, very difficult. But if you had a cut that was going all the way down, it's very easy to split that bamboo stick in half.
Asian analogy.
I have used that to explain to my patient. I've drawn it out on the paper and say like, okay, so you walk in the park and then you see this branch on the floor. Somehow it's Y-shaped. Right, and then like the top part of the Y is like really long. It's easy to snap that off. But then if we treat this like the tooth, and then we shorten the top part, then it becomes a lot less easy to break.
Actually, yeah.
So it's basically just
So you're reducing the flexion, right? I guess. Okay. Mm.
So I think traditionally when I was first learning it, it kind of braced everything together. So you really need to take the walls down, but. Now, I think, like I said, there's been a paradigm shift in the way that I'm thinking is like, I just really want to reduce how long that fracture is. Mm-hmm. And by doing that, it makes it much more difficult to crack a tooth. And so I don't need to take down the walls of the tooth. That's all of this additional tooth structure that is not necessary to remove. And I think, that has kind of driven how I end up treatment planning, whether it's going to be a more conservative bonded crown versus a traditional crown. Now I'm like, I don't need to take it all the way down anymore.
Yeah. Agreed. So. That's actually, I don't know. Do you feel like when you feel quite sad if you trim the tooth down?
Yeah.
like a healthy
die a little
tooth?
Inside.
I'm like, yeah, I'm like, dude, like
when you're
I'm
done
betraying
then...
my soul. I just feel that way. But, you know, if the patient, like, I guess, but the thing is that it's very important that we get consent, I guess.
Yeah.
So it's important.
Mm.
And I think the technicians do a wonderful job at doing it. Doing a great job. Mm. And so that's one of the things that, you know, cheap crowns, right? We haven't talked about cheap crowns yet. One of the things that the cheap crowns are, the reason why it's cheap is because they send it to a very cheap lab, right? And often cheap lab comes, you know, it's either they send it overseas or they use a very cheap material to fabricate those things. And I don't think that they actually know. I don't think patients actually know that it's cheap. And it might cause problems in the future. Have you seen that case things before as well?
Definitely. I mean, like, to be fair, how are patients going to know unless...
They can't know, yeah.
Like, I want a crown, and then a crown comes back. They really don't know where that crown came from, right?
Yeah.
But, I mean, that's certainly the case. And I think... The problem with not having the control over where that crown is made is you don't know how they process the crowns. You don't know the lab techs, how much training they've had in order to make those crowns. And so that can, end of the day, make quite a big difference. Like, for example, you know, there's a long process for like sintering crowns and things like that. If you don't do that right, you're ultimately going to have a weaker crown that can end up fracturing faster. So,
you have cracks in sight as well. Yeah.
Exactly. So, it's helpful for us to know, I think, as clinicians, like, I know where my crown's made, like, literally 20 feet away from me.
Yeah.
I was working hard to get this crown done before the end of the day. So it's helpful that we know that their process is very robust. And
Yeah, I mean, like, I had a few patients from overseas, and they came back, and in, like, less than 3 months, the veneers broke or the crowns broke. Mm-hmm. And then they obviously were not happy with it. So, I mean, to be honest with you, even though they charge high, you might still get cheap materials. It's so hard to like quality control, right? And I don't really understand why the dentists want to do that, because it's actually a lot more trouble for them to.
Mm.
Because if it breaks, you know, you can only cut so much corners before things breaks, right? Yeah. So I really don't want that to happen.
Mm.
With crowns, you have worked in a chairside practice before, right? Have you?
What kind of
practice? A chairside practice before.
Oh, yes, I have.
Okay. And how's the same day experience for the patients?
I mean, I think the patients really enjoy it. Like, they enjoy, like, being able to have something, like, they can have their tooth worked on for, you know, 60 minutes or however long it takes to prep the tooth. They sit
it's just stressful for the dentist.
And then they just sit in the chair for, like, you know, another hour waiting for the crown to be done. They have a coffee, they watch some Netflix, and then, you know, you go in and you bond the crown.
Yeah.
But I will say, like, I mean, it was fine. You know, functionally, it looks fine, everything. You know, we followed all the guidelines to be able to make sure that everything looks, you know, is processed correctly. But it doesn't have the same, like, like the wow factor when you actually look at it, you know, like.
You mean the same day once? Yeah. I mean, that's the point with no lab and the dentist does it because the dentist also needs to see a patient
right. The
time when you are processing the crown, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. And so they would usually like hop in and hop out and things like that. And that's where it suffers a bit.
Mm. Yeah. I think, what I do find really interesting here is, I don't know how common it is here, but at least in our offices, we're working out of a single chair most of the time. And so, but in the US, it's usually multi-chair practices. So you're kind of hopping between like, oh, I need to go do a hygiene check or, you know, check with the patient over there. Or I need to do a filling and then I'm going to numb this patient while I'm doing another filling and then hopping back and forth, back and forth, back and forth. And so in some sense, like your time can be a little divided. But I do, the same day workflow, sometimes like you're like, oh, I need to do this crown. I need to glaze it. Oh, but I really need to, you know, I need to go and do this hygiene check over here. Like it's tough to do.
So wait, I just want to, this is digress, but how's the hygiene check like? Is it a consultation basically? It is, right? Okay.
Yeah. So. I mean, you go in there. I'm not bashing on that model, because I do think that, in the US, at least from the practices that I've been with, they work very, very closely with the hygienist, and the hygienist can really help to they're technically not allowed to diagnose, but they really help to co-discover with the dentist and is able to like give a presentation every single time. Like, hey, this such and such hasn't been in for 6 months. He's got tartar here and he's got a leaking fluid here.
He gets data for you. Basically, she gets data for you.
Exactly. Yeah. Okay. So it just makes it a very, very efficient process.
Okay. US is great at systems, I guess. Okay, cool. So in terms of what are you still doing PFMs, metal crowns? What do you think that metal crowns have a place in dentistry still? Is that something that you guys...
I don't do it, but I think that gold is probably a good material.
Yeah, I mean, if I had to choose like a metal, I'll probably choose gold.
Yeah.
If I can.
Maybe. But price is too high.
Yeah, the price is crazy now, right? But it's like you can use it as like, you know, your last bank. Then sell your proof away.
I was just having this conversation. In Singapore, I actually don't see that many metal crowns. And I also, from what I understand, it's a lot of base metal crowns.
Yes. It's a lot of like, so the metal crowns are usually like non-precious metal. And they are hard to remove, man. And they stain the teeth after that. They stain a lot. Because they like sort of corrode, I guess. But we don't really see it. Actually, do you see it often last time when you were in public?
Kind of. Usually
it's PFM though.
Yeah, porcelain PFM. With
Oh, one of the reasons why is also because I think in Singapore, there's not many labs that does like metal labs anymore. Most of them have changed it to like CAD/CAM or like, you know, ceramic based.
I find it fascinating. I mean, I used to see a lot of like gold crowns in the US.
Oh.
And I don't know, like there used to be this old stories, you know, even my predecessors from when I was in school where they'd be like, you know, cutting off gold crowns all day long. And then people would come over, the gold collectors, and they would vacuum the carpets from the dust that was generated and be able to collect the gold from the carpets. Like that's how, like, in some sense, that's how much gold they were cutting off because it was just so common at the time.
But you know, whenever I cut a gold crown, I'm like,
I'm going to keep it.
I feel so bad. Like gold dust. Yeah. I give the patient back the crown because like, you know,
yeah.
if the patient doesn't want it, the nurses usually want to take it back home, right? But I don't know how. I don't think there's a lot of gold in it.
What do you think the patients actually do with that gold crown once you give it to them?
You can actually pawn it here. You can actually pawn it.
Do you think a majority of them pawn it off?
I don't know. I don't want to ask. But yeah, no. There's actually a precious metal service. You put in the tub and then they weigh for you and they melt it for you and things like that. So you can actually do that. But yeah, you're right. I don't really see a lot of gold. I know Koreans have a lot of gold.
Oh, yes.
Yeah. I think it's in their insurance or like their national healthcare system. So something like that. So when I literally can tell that the patient is Korean. Just you see that the teeth,
the
and like, oh yeah,
like gold oils, like,
yeah,
buckle pit that's in gold, yeah.
Yeah. And then the Japanese one would be like all metal,
yes,
or silver, right?
Yes.
It's interesting.
Yeah,
I don't know about Singaporean ones. Can you tell a Singaporean teeth?
It's like everything. It's like amalgam, and then it's like,
okay, there's a lot of amalgams in Singapore. Do you think there's a lot of amalgams in Singapore?
Yes.
Yeah, and amalgams. Do you have this theory that amalgams cause cracks?
I don't think
because
that,
like, that's what a lot of people say, right? Amalgams are the one who cause cracks.
I don't think it's really the material. It's just the fact that amalgams can't be bonded to tooth. If you don't bond a composite resin properly to the tooth, it can also cause cracks. So I guess it's the way the material is being placed on the tooth, and also the size of it. Yeah, and of course other things like patient factors, like whether they bite on really hard stuff. So I guess the bigger the amalgams, more likely to see cracks. May not be because of the amalgam, but it's just the fact that you just can't be
bothered. So amalgams are the silver fillings.
Yeah.
So
But
I see a lot of amalgam fillings in Singapore. It's still present a lot.
Yeah.
And I think, you know what it is? Is it still allowed in Singapore? It is allowed in Singapore.
I mean, was taught that. That was the first thing
I mean, I was taught that, but I just don't know. Cause in Europe, I know in Europe, you can't do any more amalgams. Mm. They don't sell amalgams at all. In Singapore, I have not used amalgam.
Same.
I've
never done it on a real patient, just on the plastic model.
The only time I did a real patient was in dental school. And so it's been a while. Were you taught amalgams?
We were taught amalgams. And I've done like amalgam on patients before, but I think patients really just generally don't want them anymore anyways.
You'll be surprised, man. Like some of them.
Oh, really?
Yeah, because actually to a lot of patients, amalgam lasts a very long time.
Yes. Yeah.
Right? And it's because their experience with the composite is not ideal.
Because
it was bonded under like really bad conditions, things like that.
It's such a strange feeling. I feel like if you practice 50, 60 years placing amalgams and then to get a letter from the government saying, oh, stop placing them, they're bad for your patients. Like, they're bad for the water system. Like, it would seem like a very strange thing to just receive this paper one day in the mail and be like, oh. Last 50 years.
But do you hear about that? Like, do you remember that? This 30 years ago, there was no gloves.
Oh yes.
The dentists don't use gloves, and that's next level, man. I might not choose a profession if I.
Well, I mean, I went to dental school in San Francisco, right? And so a lot of my professors were there during the whole HIV when it started to become really, really prominent. But you look at all their surgeries, and it's like.
Oh yeah.
No gloves.
But can you imagine like it'll be full of saliva and everything? I'm like,
no.
Oh damn. Interesting. But anyway, yeah, I think I also don't believe that. Do you believe amalgam causes cracks? Like is that
I think that the preparation design is
I think that's one of the biggest things.
Like,
because it's like undermined, right? Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, undermined enamel but also like stress concentration as well. And I think that certainly that can promote,
And I think it's because it's not bonded, like what Pungrum said, that it sort of has a lot more micro movements.
Yeah.
It just moves a lot.
Yeah.
That's where it breaks. And I don't know. I think a lot of our crowns and our onlays are caused, I'm mostly replacing a lot of amalgams. And usually they have decay behind because,
It's not bonded, right? So there's leakage.
Yeah. Mm. And also because they have been placed for such a long time.
Yeah.
Yeah, so not missing amalgam. I still think that amalgam is pretty good.
Yeah.
I mean, considering it was invented, I don't know, when was it? That, like early 1900s? Like,
this is GV Black.
Yeah, like pretty amazing material.
Do you all remember this name?
yeah, GV Black.
Yeah.
Amalgam. I think it's still available, if I'm not wrong. I remember I was in dental school and run, like, you know, because the mixer is like, they purposely put the mixer super far away from my chair. I had like,
discourage you.
And then they use like fast set. Like, dude.
Oh, that's like a rabbit and a tortoise, right? It's like, you can choose which setting you want it to be mixed at.
Yeah.
That was the same thing with like the PVS impressions too, right? You guys also had it like super far away, and then you had to like run over before it set.
Oh no, we could bring it.
We use the guard. We use the
guard. Fancy.
Fancy. Gotta be very fit then when you're in dental school. Gotta run like to the chest.
And then you reach the station and then you ask for it and then the nurse is like, tell me the exact name. Otherwise I'm not giving it to you. Like, ah, this, I can't remember.
Yeah. Dental school was, would you do dental school again?
Am I allowed to say no?
I mean,
It's really, really,
I guess it's just something I had to go through.
It's the same as medical doctors, right? They wouldn't want to do their residency, like the internship again, because it's like so many hours of no sleeping and things like that.
I think dental school itself is like, maybe I wouldn't want to do it, but to get to where I am right now, I had to go through it and it's just something in life.
Like bootcamp, I guess.
Yeah. It's just life, I guess. It's to go through. It's not always going to be like really nice. Yeah.
And okay, cool. I mean, what do you think of crowns for the front teeth? Do you feel that crowns, because you know, like there's a notion that you should do crowns after root canals, right? For the back teeth, we gotta do crowns, right? Or like on lace. But for the front teeth, what's your thoughts on that?
Depends again, I guess, like how badly broken down the tooth is. Are we trying to change other things like the size, shape, color? I think all those things will come into that you have to consider before. But if it's like a really quite a pristine tooth, maybe the tooth just had trauma and it's just a little small accessible at the back that you need to do root canal treatment on, probably don't have to do it.
Same as for you.
Yeah, same thing. Yeah. But I think something that's important to realize is that it's kind of a continuum now, right? Like, you can make extremely conservative indirects. Maybe you don't call it a crown. Maybe it'll be a veneer or something like that. But, like, you can make something that's extremely conservative. But, like, before it used to be very much a distinction, like maybe aggressive crown versus, like, filling. But now I think that there's definitely a blend between the two. So you can still get those porcelain aesthetics that you want, the beautiful shape changes and color changes and things like that, but also be really conservative in a way that you weren't able to do before.
Like a veneer or something like that is a lot more conservative, yeah.
But definitely, like, this gray area now. Like, it's like a... Yeah, it's no longer different camps. It's definitely, like, a transition.
Yeah, you're right. And like, I think it's so important to have a consultation and like, you know, sort of understand the whole entire concerns. Because I might do a crown I usually don't do a crown or root canal tooth in front.
Yeah.
But like, you know, if the patients say, hey, look, I want to change aesthetics of things and I want to change the size, things like that. And you know, it could be a crown, right? So, but it's quite amazing how we actually do the crowns nowadays for front teeth, right? I mean, the lab really put a lot of work to put stains in and whatnot.
I mean, they're really artists, like really, really artists. It's like amazing. When I get a custom shade and the lab tech comes in with their little blue tints and their little brushes and they're seeing stuff that I just can't see because I feel like, you know, they have to center it and so the color changes, but they can anticipate what that color change is going to be. But a little stroke here, a little decalcification, a little white here. And you're, huh? All right, you do your thing. You know?
It's crazy. I'm like, and like, have you, like, if, I'm sure you've seen before, like, people who put on, like one tooth, one crown in the front, and it looks, like, so different from the other ones. Like, dude. it's a big thing. And I think a lot of it to do with PFM as well. You tend to get a lot of grayish show. By the way, is PFM still a big thing in America, or is it?
It's becoming less so, but again, going back to Pung Ri's point, I think it's a cost issue at this point, right?
Even PFM?
Because it's, we usually, I mean, whenever I do PFM, it's usually going to be like a noble metal, like under, for the substrate.
Oh, okay.
So,
over here it's just mostly non-precious metal. I'm allowed to say that it's true. It's statistically true.
PFMs, they can be quite expensive.
Okay. Oh, so it's more expensive to make a PFM crown compared to Because over here it's cheaper. Which I don't really see the logic of. Yeah.
Yeah, I think, I mean, I would still use occasionally like base metal PFMs, but I would use it on like long span bridges, like bridges that are really, really, yeah, really large.
Okay.
Those, I haven't made the leap to making long span zirconia bridges at this point. I don't know if I'm mentally quite there yet. If it was a really long span bridge, like maybe 4 or 5 units, I'd probably, in my hands, probably want to stick to a PFM for now. I don't know if you guys think differently, but that's where PFM still has a place for me.
Okay. No, so the reason why I'm saying is, it's funny because, like, actually PFM is so much more harder to make.
Oh, yeah.
Like, lab-wise. but dentists and everyone is charging cheaper for it to be made, and then, like, it doesn't make sense.
Then that's where where certain labs where they'll take shortcuts, right?
Yeah,
like they'll ultimately have to take shortcuts in order for them to make. I mean, at the end of the day, these labs are a business, and, you know, like in order for them to make it work and produce that cost and volume, like
it needs to be like an operator. It's not an artist. It's just like a person who just does one thing. Yeah. So I mean, yeah, you're right. The technicians are really, really artists, and they get really, really, really frustrated if the color's not right, and like they actually.
It's funny, you know, when I first came to this office, there was a posterior crown on a patient who had like some crazy, like I don't know, tetracycline staining, or I don't know, generalized hypocalcification around his teeth, and the lab made this crown. I'm like, wow, like. They really put all that in there, and you know, I think my patient was also astonished because, well, one, I had to point out which tooth it was, but I think he almost thought maybe it would look better if it didn't have any of all these like characterizations. Like, he's like, can we just start doing that one at a time on all of my teeth? Like, you know, like trying to be able to take away these characterizations and make them look nicer, but, they can make things look so good and realistic to the point where it's like, maybe it's a little too realistic.
Yeah, you're right. You know, so I always have to give like the option, like, do you want like stains or like you just like, you want white, like, you know, cause people actually think that it's like decay, right?
Yeah.
Like some of the technicians, they've done it like so well that like, I'm just so worried that somebody else thinks it's like a natural tooth and like,
Do a PRR on your stain.
Yeah, and I just, hey, it's decay and like, it's my, and it's like a crown. So,
right.
I'm so worried about that. I think we're giving the reader, like viewers, like unexpected expectations of, like, sort of unattainable expectations about our lab because they're humans, guys.
I have worked with a lot of labs and they do a very excellent job.
Yeah.
Yeah,
I mean, that's great. Thank you so much. I think the lab technicians are, They work really hard.
Yeah. And not just crowns, right? Like even like the conservative preparations that we were talking about where maybe you still have quite a lot of tooth popping out from the gums and then you have to make everything blend in really nicely with just like one third or just half the tooth. It's really nice. Like I really can't tell. And I show the patient the photos that we took and it's like,
you know, the worst thing is that when you like, you know, it's wrong, like the color's not nice. But then you like, the dentist tries to like, yeah, it looks great. Like, you know what I mean? Like, yeah, oh yeah, I can't tell the difference, man. It looks great, but it looks like,
yeah.
Well, you know, I tried doing that. I'm like, I kind of do this. Sorry. I need to change this. Okay, so as you know, over here, do you have anything to say to any patients who are, what's the number one questions you get asked about crowns all the time?
How much are they?
Okay, how much are they? All right, and that's another one. That's a big question.
Yeah.
Do I need to get a root canal because I need to do a crown now?
Oh yeah,
I think that's a big one, right?
It goes hand in hand. A lot of people.
Yeah, I don't know where that comes from. Is it locally only, or like, do you feel that it's?
I think it's usually patients who have had prior experience. Like, this is not their first crown. They've had root canals and crowns together on previous teeth, and then you're recommending a crown or maybe earlier on before they're having any symptoms. And they're like, so I need a root canal on that tooth, right? And you're like, no. We're trying to get it to the point at the point where you don't need a root canal. Yeah. That's the whole point of this right now. That's not the norm to necessarily get a root canal. We try to avoid that as much as we can.
But I guess also, like, bad experience with crowns, and then they get like a lot of pain and sensitivity after that, and then they had to do root canal treatment after the crown.
According to the literature, I think it's a 3-5% chance you get a root canal, right? After a crown.
Mm.
But I know there are some dentists who would usually do the root canal straight away before putting a crown on. So, it's just weighing the risk. So if they feel that the decay is really, really large.
Yeah.
And because of that, there's a very high chance of the tooth fracturing and also having a root canal problem. They might preemptively do a root canal first before putting a crown. And I think that's a fair thing.
Mm.
Okay, cool. What's the other common questions that you get asked?
Whether or not a crown's going to come off.
Do you get that? You guys, when you do bonding, right? Do you get patients always ask you, like, hey, like, can it really, like, will it not drop off? Like, it looks so small.
It's hard to say it won't drop off.
But how would you tell them?
I just tell them that.
Trust me.
No, I think they have to understand that there's a risk of that happening.
Yeah.
But I try to make them understand the rationale. So choosing between that, and also, like, maybe a total tooth fracture, right? If you do like a really aggressive crown preparation. So yeah. I guess it's really just pros and cons. There are always pros and cons in everything.
Mm-hmm.
I tell them that there's a chance of that happening. And of course, I also reassure them that I'm going to do everything I can to minimize the chance of that happening.
I think the best part about it also is that, if you drop off, what's the harm, right? You can either do a new one or we just go be more aggressive at that point in time.
Yeah.
So,
always be more aggressive later on.
Yeah. Yeah, but you can't be more aggressive first then be less aggressive after that. Right?
Keeping your options open.
That's true. So what I usually say to my patients about why is it so thin, things like that. I always say is that, like, it's like a towel. So, like one of those marble towels. Yes.
That's a good one.
Yeah. And then, so if you, like, you take a towel and you just drop it on the floor, it breaks, right? But if you cement it to the floor, like what you do on the tooth, and you drop a bowling ball on it, it doesn't break. So it just becomes biomimetic. And that's like the buzzword you get that in America as well, biomimetic dentist and everything. So, but biomimetic dentist is basically someone who respects the tooth structure and try to save the tooth structure because biomimetic means it basically mimics
biology.
Biology.
Yeah. So right? try to restore the tooth.
Try to explain better. Yeah.
Restoring the tooth way that mimics what the tooth used to be.
Yes.
So
regaining back the strength.
Yeah.
Right? That's like,
correct.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. So like, certain parts of the teeth have this kind of mechanical property, so we just use the right materials for this. That's true. It's biomimetic, right? So
yeah. So it's just regaining back the strength and essentially, because a conventional crown doesn't do that. Am I right?
Yeah, because it's disconnected, right? If you don't bond the crown, then the restoration and the underlying tooth, they're just functioning not as a single unit. But if you bond and everything, then it's kind of trying to restore the tooth back to, I guess, former glory, if you want to put it that way. It's never the same, but we try, right? Yeah.
The things we say. Okay. I think we're done. With that ending, let's end our podcast. Thank you so much for having us today. I'll see you guys in the next one. All right, thank you.
Thanks, guys.
Thanks. Bye.
Bye.